Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today we start with a focus on grapes. During the last month, the U.S. table grape market has been rather slow, giving priority to other seasonal fruits. FreshFruitPortal.com says currently the North American supply is mainly composed of Californian and Mexican grapes, as well as first volumes arriving from Peru. Last month, the movement of table grapes was rather sluggish, they say, and fruit has begun to show some condition problems due to the slow rotation of the stored grapes. Adding to the problem, extreme heat events that have affected the production valleys and therefore the fruit's quality. It's expected that with less competition from seasonal fruit in October, there will be an upturn in demand, which so far has been focused on higher caliber fruit. You can read more of that report on FreshFruitPortal.com. Grapes are once again Kern County's top crop. They ranked number one in gross value in the 2020 Kern County Crop Report's top 20 commodities. The report was released this week at a County Board of Supervisors meeting. Grapes produced about $1.5 billion in value for Kern County in 2020. The crop was followed by citrus at second and almonds at third. Pistachio and milk were fourth and fifth, respectively. Hazel Technologies Incorporated, the developer of new USDA-funded technologies to protect produce quality, announced a partnership with Jasmine Vineyards, a San Joaquin Valley-based table grape grower-packer-shipper of more than a dozen different varieties. Jasmine Vineyards plans to integrate Hazel products across their grape portfolio to extend grape shelf life throughout the California grape season. In addition to being a key supplier for the U.S. market, Jasmine Vineyards ships worldwide and is utilizing Hazel's products in their containers traveling to Asia, Oceania, and other global destinations. California Central Valley is the capital of research, innovation, and flavor for the table grape category. The California Table Grape Commission notes the season in the Central Valley spans from June to January, when the region's 350-plus growers dedicate themselves to cultivating 80 different varieties, ranging from classic cultivars to dynamic new breeds. News from the rest of the ag industry is coming up right after this. We'll be right back.
AgriMajor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgriMajor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgriMajor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. The Department of Agriculture this week announced the Climate Smart Agriculture and Forestry Partnership Initiative. Michael Clement shares more on what that means for farmers and ranchers.
The Climate Smart Agriculture and Forestry Partnership Initiative, announced by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, seeks to promote climate smart agricultural practices. Andrew Walmsley, American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Congressional Relations Director, says the announcement is the start of that process.
So Secretary Vilsack announced a new initiative hoping to promote the opportunities around climate smart agricultural practices and commodities. And what the Secretary's announcement does is kick off a process to start a series of pilot projects that will inform the department to hopefully provide information to Congress or future initiatives around the development of climate-smart ag practices.
The Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance, founded last year, is a diverse group of organizations focused on voluntary, incentive-based climate solutions. Walmsley says the group provided recommendations to USDA.
One of the recommendations from the group was the development of pilot projects with USDA to identify barriers in participation in carbon markets or to access new opportunities with climate smart ag practices. And so a lot of those recommendations from the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance we see in the announcement that the Secretary made this week.
For farmers and ranchers, he says they are part of the solution when it comes to climate policy.
This initiative hopefully provides answers to a lot of the questions that are out there, especially focusing on pilot projects. It's the idea of walking before you run to try to answer some of those questions. So there is a comment period that USDA is seeking more information on, and many of your ag commodity groups and the Food and Agriculture Alliance will be weighing in with USDA to make sure the program is focused on farmer-friendly practices.
Learn more at fb.org. Michael Klimitz, Washington.
The U.S. Grains Council is setting up a framework of cooperation with officials in Ecuador and Vietnam. Chad Smith has details.
The council signed a memorandum of understanding with each country with the goal to expand market opportunities for U.S. grains in all forms in the future. Carrie Sifferath is Senior Director of Global Programs for the U.S. Grains Council. He says the memorandum with Ecuador will involve advancing ethanol use throughout the country.
Right now, Ecuador has an E5 blend and wanting them to understand the way to make sure you meet that E5 blend and even talking them to go to an E10 blend to have trade be part of that. But to work with the government and the petro industry there, along with the ethanol producers that we're in this jointly, we're wanting to make sure that some of that is met from their local production. And when their local production can't meet all of their blending requirements, that they allow free trade of ethanol imports to make up the remaining part of it.
He says the MOU with Vietnam is important because they've been a great buyer of U.S. distillers' dried grains with solubles.
Right now, I think they're our number two customer behind Mexico, and wanted to make sure we can extend and continue to see DDGS exports to that. It has a very large and growing feed and livestock industry. We work real hard to see DDGS being used there in swine and poultry diets, but have even continued to look at ways to break into the aquaculture side of things, the booming aquaculture, both on shrimp and some fresh and seawater fish there.
Vietnam also does buy corn from the U.S., but Sifferath says there is room for growth.
Vietnam is contemplating reducing import tariffs on corn and wheat, and we had an opportunity to talk about the need for that to happen, which would make U.S. corn even more competitive into the Vietnam market and allow us to gain more market share there. When we even talked about the need to lower tariffs on fuel ethanol, and we do see some shipments of U.S. ethanol to Vietnam and would like to see that continue to grow in their ethanol blending policy they have there. And right now, they've already reduced it from 20 to 15%, but really need them to reduce it down to 5% so that ethanol becomes competitive with other oxygenates, which are tariff-free. At 5%.
He expects to see more MOU signings with other customers in the future.
I'm sure there will be. We're always looking for opportunities to expand exports of U.S. feed grains in all the forms. And so it's hard to know exactly where, but we're always looking for opportunities to do that. And signing MOUs, again, with governments or with industry, allows us to kind of sit down and have a mutual agreement going forward, how we can work together so that it's beneficial for both sides, both the importing country and obviously the U.S. is excited to be able to export our products around the world, but we need to make sure it's beneficial for that importing country as well.
Again, that's Carrie Sifferath of the U.S. Grains Council. Chad Smith reporting.
Food prices have been climbing for at least 18 months. Is there an end in sight? Gary Crawford has the latest forecast.
Grocery store food prices on average usually increase every year, say by about 2%. We'll let this sound represent the usual 2% or so food price hike that we see in most years. Last year, though, with COVID, prices jumped 3.5%. At the beginning of this year, most analysts thought that we'd see prices back off after the COVID-related food chain disruptions of 2020, but no, prices continue to rise at a good clip, and now...
People are talking a lot about how it's possible that this might become a new normal after a lot of the supply chain disruptions that have happened in the last year and a half.
Agriculture Department economist and food price tracker Carolyn Chelius says she's not quite ready to go that far, a new normal, but at least for the next 6 months to a year.
We do think that this pattern of food price increases is going to continue.
And she expects grocery store food prices this year to end up rising possibly by as much as they did this year at 3.5%.
We are seeing an upward trend in a number of food price categories. For example, we've continued to see increases in the prices of meats and fish and seafood. And some of these increases are pretty large in magnitude.
Which will strain our already overburdened and non-existent sound effects department. Now, if you buy meat at the grocery store, you've probably noticed when they scan your item, over the last year and a half, those meat prices have kept on going up and up and at a pretty good clip. And
that's not going to slow within 2021.
Carolyn Chelius says compared to this time 1 year ago, we're paying over 6% more for poultry, almost 10% more for pork, and 12% more, here it comes, 12% more for beef generally. I'd like to give you a breakout on the increases of the various cuts of beef, pork, and poultry, but I don't think I can stand the noise. What's contributing to higher prices? Chelia says, first, it's costing farmers and ranchers a lot more to feed their animals. The cost of feed for livestock is up, 20 to 30%. Plus, there are other factors pushing meat and food prices up.
Transportation prices have been high. Demand is still extremely high, both domestic and international, for products like meat. And then supply has been lower to stable, I'd say.
Chelius is forecasting more price hikes for meat and most foods next year as well, though maybe the hikes will be smaller. Maybe.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. After all, it's a bit early to accurately forecast what's going to happen a year from now, right?
That is true.
So, as you and all great forecasters say, Carolyn...
We'll see.
That's right, we'll see. Just know that whatever you predict, I am with you 100%. Oh, no. This is what's left of Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And here's a fun story for our Friday show. One of the U.S. Forest Service's iconic symbols celebrates his 50th anniversary this year with continued focus on messages of conservation and preventing pollution. Rod Bain reports.
A golden anniversary for a pollution prevention and conservation icon.
No one knows this message of conservation better than Woodsy Owl!
Help Woodsy spread the word. Come on, never be a dirty bird.
Mason Amchat Edwards of the U.S. Forest Service introducing this legend during a recent Facebook Live video. Just one of several events celebrating the 50th anniversary of Woodsy. The same event gave opportunity for the famous owl and friends to relay some of his history, starting with his creation in 1971, at the start of the environmental movement.
The first Earth Day was held in April 1970 to encourage all Americans to take action to help the environment.
The Forest Service decided that they needed a new mascot to encourage the public and children to protect and conserve the environment.
Which made sense considering the Forest Service's track record with successful, iconic spoke symbols.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
And it didn't take long for Woodsy's catchphrase to catch on with the American public. As well as his messages about addressing pollution.
We've been polluting the water with all kinds of junk like paper, cans, and gooey gunk. It looks ugly and it's killing our fish and ducks. Please don't throw junk in the water. Give a hoot. Don't pollute.
Then on Earth Day 1997, both Woodsy's image...
I updated my looks. I got a backpack, some hiking shoes, and cool field pants.
And message...
I like to say, lend a hand, care for the land.
Morphed into their present forms. But what exactly does lend a hand, care for the land mean?
The idea is for all of us, and especially kids, to form a healthy relationship with nature and explore the outdoor world around us. I also built on my original message of give a hoot, don't pollute, by inviting kids to think about the four R's.
To renew, reuse, recycle, and let compost rot.
Woodsy over the years has also taken to social media to spread his message, such as his own Twitter account, @WoodsyOwl, and his own Forest Service webpage, www.fs.usda.gov/woodsy-owl, which contains links for educational resources and activities for kids as they learn how to
lend a hand, care for the land.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news for today. Taylor Chalstrom is up next with more for the grape industry.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, this is Taylor with My Ag Life. We wrapped up our annual Crop Consultant Conference last week, and I got the chance to speak with UCCE IPM specialist Kent Dana about his talk at the conference, which discussed biology of and pest management strategies for vine mealybug in grapevines. Here is that interview from the conference. Kent, can you give us a general little overview about vine mealybug first to start off?
Sure. So vine mealybug has become one of the most important pests of vineyards in California. We know it came from the Middle Eastern area, probably Israel. Normally it is from the Mediterranean region. So you can find vine mealybug populations from Spain to France to Italy to Greece. Also in North Africa, Egypt, Israel. Our population is most likely from Israel and most likely came from someone bringing in table grape material from that country. This is why it's so important not to bring in wood that you don't know where it's from.
That is a really good point. I'm curious, you know, these vine mealybugs, they have this really distinct appearance. It's almost like this white velvety look. Are they really easy to spot? Out there. Well,
that's what's so funny is that they're actually not easy to find at the beginning of an infestation. So all the photos that you see are close-up pictures, usually of the adult stages. They've got this wax secretion that covers their body. Each time they molt, they lose that, and they become kind of a slight pinkish or purplish colored insect. And the crawlers, the first instar stage, is only about a millimeter in size. And so you can get thousands of mealybugs on a vine underneath the bark and not see them at all. Okay. It's really when the population gets much larger, where they're starting to secrete so much honeydew, that the growers start to realize the population's there. That's why I like to use pheromone traps. You can see the population building up in the vineyard before you can actually find it clustered on a corner of the vineyard block on five or six vines.
It's really important, and that was one thing you brought up in your presentation a lot, the use of pheromones and mating disruption for this pest. How big of a problem has this pest really been in grapevines, and how can mating disruption be used to kind of mitigate it at this point?
So again, I think, in my opinion, it's the most important insect pest of vineyards right now in California. California is the only state in North America that's got the vine mealybug. Other states, Oregon, Washington, throughout the East Coast, have got the native grape mealybug. So the vine mealybug is an invasive mealybug pest, which is in California, and it really has changed our pest management program. So, for example, we just lost lorazepam. Lorazepam was really primarily used for vine mealybug as a delayed dormant. And if you look at crop use reports from Oregon and Washington, you don't see Movento being used very commonly. You never saw lorazepam being used very much. That's because those products and Admire were really focused on this vine mealybug. So it definitely has changed the insecticide use in California, and of course the mating disruption use as well.
You stressed the importance of mating disruption as well as insecticide use kind of in tandem. And you mentioned this study you did where combining two insecticides, kind of a double application, actually seemed to work better, if I'm not mistaken. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so that's another good point from the talk. And it's not so much that in the past, a single insecticide did not work. Years and years ago, when vine mealybug first got into California, when we would put on Admire, a neonicotinoid, through the drip system, we ended up with season-long control. And then slowly, it didn't seem to work quite as well. Then we found Movento, spirotetramat. We put that on as a single application. We got, you know, year-long control. Sometimes we didn't see a mealybug for 2 years. Now growers seem to be going in with more than one insecticide to try to bring the mealybug population down to control. And remember, the mealybug is a vector of grape leaf-associated virus. So in the past, when growers were thinking about control for a cosmetic pest of grapes, now for wine grapes, they're thinking about it as an insect vector. So the tolerance has really decreased. We have to keep the population much lower than we used to consider an economic threshold.
Definitely, and one thing you mentioned about getting that population threshold down, or that population in general, is using insecticides to get it to a level and then implementing a mating disruption to get it to an even lower level than the insecticides can do on their own. You know, how important really is that?
Right, and that's why the combination of insecticides are sometimes useful. There's a lot of good products out there. We've got organophosphate still, some are registered, carbamate still, one is registered, but Movento, the neonicotinoids, the insect growth regulators, these are all great, but we don't want to use one all the time. We want to mix our chemistries to help reduce or slow down the development of resistance. And mating disruption, it's a great tool added to the toolbox, but just think about it. You've got this clumped population of mealybugs. You've got a male emerging as a winged adult male, a little tiny insect. But if the vine has got 1,000 mealybugs and the male has to move 1 inch to find a female, it's going to move 1 inch and find a female. Mating disruption works when the population is so low, the male's got to take flight to find the female 2, 3, 4 vines down the way. And so mating disruption needs to have that population low. It works out great in one way too. Insecticides, we've got a lot of good products. If you've got a high mealybug population and you put on any of the standard materials, you're going to get 90-95% kill or more. But there's still a population that remains. So mating disruption works better at those lower densities. So it works in combination with insecticides. Use insecticides first, mating disruption once you got the population controlled to maintain a low level and to keep moving it lower and lower each year, and then start to use it in combination with some of the good natural enemies like the parasites that work fairly well at low mealybug densities as well.
Yeah, you actually talked about a couple of those biologicals and in your presentation as well. I forget at the moment which specific one you referenced. You put a video of it up on the screen. Can you explain that one and how it's being implemented at the moment? Maybe
sure.
Any of the work that's being done.
So the natural enemies kind of fall out into two groups, predators and parasitoids. Of the predators, there's really two important groups, the green lacewings and the mealybug destroyer, or the beetles. Green lacewing is kind of a light green as an adult, long wings, looks very fragile as it flies. The larvae have got sickle-like mouth parts. And in fact, if you're a Star Trek fan, I think it was the second movie, when Sulu had an alien invade his body, and what they showed was a close-up of a green lacewing coming out of Sulu's ear, instead of doing some kind of great big mechanics, or this was before they did a lot of video alteration with I don't even know what you call it these days.
CGI.
Yeah, this was just a little green lacewing that you can buy from one of the insectaries.
It was literally a green lacewing.
It was literally a green lacewing coming out of Sulu's ear, just a close-up of that. So these predators work fairly well when the mealybug density is somewhat high. Mm-hmm. David Haviland's doing a great job now looking at dispersion. My issue with these predator groups is getting it out in the vineyard and spreading it out so the population is still viable, strong, alive, able to kill the mealybug. Mm-hmm. The parasite, and the one I work with quite closely, is Anagyrus pseudococci, no common name. You can also purchase it from insectaries. It works a little bit better at mealybugs at lower densities. The issue with all of these is getting it from the insectaries and getting it out to the field in a live, viable condition.
Yeah.
And in fact, we just bought a set of Anagyrus from a European company, and there was 75% mortality when it arrived at our doorstep.
Wow.
So that's still an issue. They're out there naturally in your vineyard. There are things you can do to increase their numbers naturally. Most important thing is to manage your insecticides so you're not using a lot of the broad spectrum contact materials which kill these natural enemies.
That's a good sentiment there. I have another question, kind of related but unrelated. Is this pest, you say it's vine mealybug is specific to California in terms of North America, right?
As an invasive species.
As an invasive
It's only
species.
Been found in California. Oregon, it can get there eventually, so be careful.
And within California, is it really only certain regions or climates that it's in, or is it like extremely widespread within these vineyards?
It's very widespread within California. I don't know that it's in Mendocino yet. In fact, I've been told it's not in Mendocino. But from Coachella Valley up throughout Napa, Sonoma, throughout the Central Coast, you can find it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for providing some more information on
sure.
This really seemingly important pest. Hopefully, with David Haviland's work, there will be some things to look forward to in terms of biologicals and hopefully insecticides and mating disruption in the future. Kent, thank you for being here today at the Crop Consultant Conference and here with me right now talking about this important subject.
Thank you, Taylor.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Shocks to the U.S. beef supply chain the past 2 years have led to discussions and study on how to improve resiliency through the system. Rod Bain and economic experts of the livestock sector look at ways that supply disruptions can be minimized and product availability is not reduced. That's in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The Holcomb, Kansas beef plant fire. The COVID-19 pandemic.
the cyber attack of the world's largest meat producer. All deemed shocks, black swan events for the beef industry and challenges to the nation's beef supply chain over the last 2 years. So how can the supply chain adapt to become more resilient going forward?
Livestock producers must coordinate and commit production via contracting.
Additional operational capacity does not solely have to come from new facilities. Increased technology implementation will be critical to success.
The costs of adding packing capacity are not limited to concrete and iron. I encourage you to consider other barriers that limit new entrants.
I'm Rod Bain. And coming up, what analysts from the livestock and land-grant university sectors think should be done to make the nation's beef supply chain more resilient in this edition of Agriculture USA. A recent House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing studying shocks to the beef supply chain and how to create a system more resilient to such shocks brought together experts from the private sector and the nation's land-grant universities to share their thoughts. In terms of how the supply chain is rebounding from those shocks presently, Purdue University economist Jason Lusk and Rabo AgriFinance analyst Dustin Ahern observe.
Beef cattle system responded remarkably well. Cattle prices have been on the rise. Consumer demand is strong.
2020's cattle backlog is nearly cleared. Year over year, cattle prices are already improving and should continue to do so through the second half of 2021.
Yet in terms of what should be done going forward, Lusk notes that an understanding of history within the cattle market is important in crafting future supply chain flexibilities.
There are long lags and ripple effects in cattle markets. Don't overly focus on what is happening today, but make policies for the future.
Policies to address challenges such as packing capacity, increased transparency in price discovery, and expanding market opportunities for producers of all sizes. Kerry Jacobs of the University of Missouri says one way to assure small-scale livestock producer ownership will have opportunity for success is through cooperative-style models, with emphasis on the cooperation.
Concentration in the livestock industry, particularly at the processing stage, seems inevitable from an efficiency lens. Through cooperation, however, livestock producers can participate in generating and receiving the value this efficiency creates. When at scale, producer ownership can smooth variability in producer incomes because it allows them to capture income from downstream markets that may be less volatile.
She believes that could come in the form of contracting.
We do have examples of large-scale producer ownership in pork. Triumph Foods is producer-owned, and its structure reflects the characteristics of cooperatives that discipline a market. The producer's owners have long-term contracts to sell hogs, and they effectively earn wholesale meat prices for their animals.
Cooperation will also play a key part in preventing future cyber attacks on segments of our nation's beef supply chain. That according to the University of Minnesota's Jennifer Vandelite. She says USDA, Homeland Security, and FBI coordination and collaboration is needed in the way of risk reduction and cybersecurity education efforts. Although,
not only does managing cyber risk increase operational costs, but there are very few experts with the knowledge and experience to effectively enhance cybersecurity in the food and ag operational environment. This type of expert is often recognized as irreplaceable. We need to train and field many more of them.
Vandelite adds the threat of cyber attacks on food systems will continue to grow due to the integration of IT systems within the supply chain, hence the priority to fortify these networks from cyber incidents. An example of the impacts of compromised systems is the shutdown of one of the only two milk jug preform plants in the nation during Hurricane Katrina.
The supply of fluid milk at the consumer level plummeted to shortage levels in many areas of the country, while dairy farmers dumped millions of gallons of milk.
Rabo AgriFinance's Dustin Ahern adds that differentiated product models in the beef supply chain.
Alternative marketing agreements are the best way to secure a consistent supply of such differentiated cattle. Strong vertical supply chain relationships will be critical to the success of any new beef business.
And increased technology development.
Startups are also bringing outside expertise to advance technology and automation. 1% improvement in volume efficiency across all existing plants would add 1,000 head of daily fed cattle processing capacity.
Will play a part in building the resiliency of the nation's beef supply chain, both now and in the future. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.